The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Amateur Traveler, episode 694. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about mountains and mosques and jingle trucks, the world's most dangerous bridge, the Kalash people, and the Karakoram Highway as we go to northern Pakistan. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen, and I think we have a treat for you in today's episode. So let's talk about Pakistan. I'd like to welcome to the show David Harden from TravelWornSatchel.com, who's come to talk to us about northern Pakistan. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you. Nice to be here.
Your accent is clearly not one from northern Pakistan. We're talking to you while you're in the UK near Windsor. What led you to Pakistan?
I'll give you the shortened version, but when I was 18, I decided to travel overland from the UK to Australia. And I got as far as Afghanistan.
Before you realized you'd run out of land?
It was that and the Russians got in the way. So.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that happens, doesn't it? I was away 2 years and decided that I still want to go along the Silk Roads. I'm still interested in Islamic culture and art and architecture. And so I've been filling in the gaps ever since. So I've sort of done Australia and parts of Southeast Asia and all of Europe and a few of the stans, but Pakistan was always there and the one that I needed to tick off, really.
Well, and you chose northern Pakistan on this particular trip, which, as we were talking beforehand, you said is quite different from southern Pakistan, and that would be a whole different trip.
North and south is very, very different. I mean, the north, it's called the northern areas, and basically consists of three huge mountain ranges. So you have to the west, you have the Hindu Kush, in the center, you have the Karakorams, and then surrounded on the north and east by the Himalayas. And they're absolutely wonderful mountain ranges. But as you get further south, Islamabad, where I flew into the Great Trunk Road, it becomes plains. Pakistan also becomes desert, all the way down to Karachi, which is on the Arabian Sea. So, yeah, they're very two distinct areas.
Well, shall we start then in Islamabad?
I actually just flew into Islamabad. Islamabad is a modern city. And one of the interesting things is that there's a city right next door to it as well, Pindi, which is the ancient city. But Islamabad is the modern city of Pakistan, built very much along grid lines, very easy to navigate. I would say that actually just before I started this trip, I'd originally planned to buy a motorbike in Islamabad and then travel up through the Karakoram Highway and then head off, you know, to various places that I'd read about in various books. I have to say that I spoke to, there's a big Pakistan community here in the UK, and sure, I have a couple of friends, one who's a Kashmiri, and he said, well, to be honest, I know you're a good motorcyclist, but the roads are something else, and I would recommend a Jeep at least. So I said, you better listen to this sort of thing. I listened to him, and I got myself a Jeep and a guide, so who met me actually at Islamabad Airport. And I spoke to them over a number of weeks, number of months, really, setting out an itinerary. And he kind of found out about what I wanted to do. And that was great. And so I had this, a Jeep and a driver. And I have to say, it was probably the best decision I made. I mean, normally I would travel alone and make my way around. But I think this would have been a journey too far.
How did you find a Jeep and a driver?
There's a Kashmiri gentleman here in the UK who promotes northern Pakistan. A wonderful gentleman, and he put me in touch with various people over there, and I came up with one, Ishan, who turned out to be absolutely brilliant. And the good thing was that he said, well, here's the itinerary, but often as not, we would turn off the road and go, and he'd say, oh, there's something really interesting up here. I suggest we don't do this, or And I think that another question on people's lips before I went, were, what about safety? Because one has this image, of course, of Pakistan, and especially kind of the northern areas. And, you know, I part of the trip I'd planned was to go up towards Afghanistan. So, and he kind of took care of it. Sometimes, Chris, when you meet someone that you have absolute confidence that you've made a really good decision, I really felt that. Towards the back end of the trip, we ended up in Peshawar. He said...
Near the Afghanistan border, yeah.
He'd said, had I gone 2 weeks earlier, he wouldn't have suggested we go to Peshawar for various security reasons. And it's nice having that, someone who has that local intelligence, so to speak. You know, he was always on his phone, was always checking where we were. And that said, there wasn't one time, the only time was rather alarmingly, I got invited into someone's house and it was an old soldier. I didn't know this, but his granddaughter, he sent his granddaughter off and I was having a cup of tea with him. And she walked in with this shotgun and was like, okay. And he sort of started brandishing this shotgun around me and I was, okay, maybe I made a mistake. Well, you know, perhaps it's too much of a price to pay for a cup of tea. But it turned out that he wanted to show me the gun, which was made, I think, in about 1960 in Birmingham, the UK. And because I was from the UK, you know, he was ever so proud of this. So probably that's that momentarily, you know, I felt unsafe. But that was it. That was the extent to how I felt unsafe in Pakistan.
Excellent. Now, you said, as I said, Islamabad, you said that's a modern city. And it sounded like in your tone I was hearing, so I didn't spend a lot of time in Islamabad. I was more interested in the mountains.
Absolutely. I mean, Islamabad, okay. I sort of passed through very quickly. In fact, we left about an hour after I landed.
Okay.
We did come back because I wanted actually to see Faisal Mosque,
okay,
which is a really beautiful mosque, a very modern mosque, finished in about 1988. Again, a very, very beautiful mosque. It's in the foothills of the Himalayas. It's great. Visit that. That's the last place I visited, but I'll tell you about that first, if I may.
Sure.
So it was built in about 1988, called the Faisal Mosque because King Faisal of Saudi Arabia stumped up the $120 million US to build it.
As one does.
You know, pocket money probably for King Faisal. But what was interesting is he made it a competition with all the architects to come up with the design. A Turkish architect, who I can't remember the name, won it. And he based the whole architecture on a Bedouin tent, which I thought was very interesting. And it, you know, obviously appealed to King Faisal. And it's a magnificent structure because it's like an eight-sided tent. And it really does look like a tent. And it's so big. I mean, it's so enormous. All white marble and gray marble. And you just see it for miles driving towards it. You're thinking, okay, you know, it looks okay. And then suddenly you sort of another 10 minutes down the road, you think, actually, I'm sure I should have been there by now. This grid system of Islamabad. So you go up a road, it's the end of the road. And I say just at the end of the road, after about sort of 20 minutes, you eventually get close to it. And then you start to really appreciate the enormity of this marvelous structure, and you can get 300,000 people praying there.
Oh my.
Yeah, I mean, inside, I think it's about 10,000, but with the porticos and
got it.
The courtyards, okay, and the grounds, you've got, you know, 300,000 people pray there. And it was a real highlight for me to kind of visit that. You're really interested in style of architecture. But the one thing is that if people do go and visit, you have to obviously take your shoes off, hand them in. And there's white marble and grayish sort of marble. And it wasn't a particularly sunny, hot day, but every time I stepped off the white marble onto the gray marble, I burnt my feet. I wanted to get an angle for a picture or kind of take a shortcut through a courtyard, and my feet were scalded. You know, but it's, and I eventually got in as well. They'd just finished prayer, and I'd gone up to the main entrance to get inside to have a look at this incredible space inside. And they said, no, I'm sorry, you can't come in. And I said, well, look, I've sort of come all the way from London to see this. And it was really nice. And this is typical of Pakistani people, that they will just try and be as helpful as possible. Really nice. And he said, okay, look, you shouldn't really, but go with this young man. And he sort of spoke to the young man in Urdu. And we trolled off around the back. This young man took me off around the back, and there was a back door. And he took my camera off me. And he said, look, no pictures. Just go inside and just have a look. And I thought it was this really, really nice touch. And again, got to tread on the carpet. I saw the minarab, and it was really nice and really serene place. Children having lessons and a really great atmosphere. And I came back, and the young man was there, gave me my camera and going back. And I was sort of going to complain to him, I said, because everyone in there had phones, they were taking selfies and pictures. And I was thinking, well, I was lucky enough to be let in, so I wasn't going to push that, but really worth a visit. There's a lot of history to this place, but that modern architecture, it was absolutely stunning. And in the surroundings of the hills with the backdrop of the foothills of the Himalayas, it's a stunning location.
Excellent. Well, shall we move off then into the Himalayas?
Left Islamabad really quite quickly and traveled up the Karakoram Highway. After a couple of hours, we went up the Karakoram Highway. After a couple of hours, we reached Abbottabad, had some lunch. Abbottabad is famous or infamous for where Osama bin Laden was held up and was eventually killed.
Okay.
You could sense there was perhaps a little bit of tension there, but nothing that would worry me in any way. After lunch at Abbottabad, we turned off and went up this track to a place called Naran, where I spent the first night. And Naran, it's a very hilly place, and it was really quite cold. It's actually a holiday town, but it only opens really from sort of May time. It's worth saying that I actually flew in middle of June, because actually going earlier to the Northern Territories, they're virtually impassable with snow. A lot of the passes, you just can't get across. So you have to time it. Whereas conversely, if you're going to the south, the best times are winter time. So we got to Naran, lots of snow about, had some really nice food. I was tired because it was an overnight flight, so sort of early to bed. Got up, and then we headed up to what's known as the Babusa Pass, which again is only opened May, June time. And that's about 4,000 meters up. One of the issues I thought I was going to have was with the altitude. So what Hassan was really good at is saying, look, we'll drive you up slowly. We'll take you up to altitude. We come back down. You can sleep. And then we go back up to altitude. So you can build that resilience to altitude, which I was really thankful for, because we got up to the Babusa Pass and it's really beautiful. I mean, you see down these two valleys and these snow-covered mountains, and you can see for miles. And I knew we were getting quite close because there was this portable toilet, because it's only open for a few months of the year. Everything's temporary. There was this portaloo stuck in the middle of nowhere. What a view! And I just thought, you know, gosh, you know, if you're going to use that, what a perfect location to sit and contemplate for a while. You come around this bend and there's this temporary village. It's marvelous. I mean, it's all caravans and corrugated iron and wood. It's all been knocked together and a few permanent houses there. And I sort of walked around and had a look at the view. And inside the houses was piled with snow, because it had so much snow, it all that drifted through into temporary houses. Huh. I say temporary because they're only inhabited, like I say, from about May through to October.
Okay. And you say caravan, and for my American listeners, your caravan is my RV, I think. We're talking about a recreational vehicle here. Okay.
I think when I say caravan in Pakistan, it's probably elevating RV to something. Okay. Or elevating something it's not, but a wooden box with wheels on the...
Got it. Okay.
I got back into the Jeep, and we headed down. We're heading down to a place called Chilas. But we'd stopped in this traffic jam off the pass. I was told that the road was blocked because the snow had come straight across the road, entirely blocked the whole road, and that we'd have to wait a couple of hours whilst it was cleared. So I walked down the road, it was fairly steep, met some young guys there, and we chatted and had some photographs taken and had a look at the snow that they were clearing. And I started to walk back up to the Jeep. And, you know, I suddenly felt really leaden-footed. I mean, it was so hard putting one foot in front of the other and breathing. And I thought, I've really got this altitude thing. And the guide and the driver were really good. They recognized it. They sat me down, gave me some loads of water and a couple of sweets to suck. And we moved after about an hour, but after about 10, 15 minutes, I was fine. It struck me then that I really made the right decision to go with these guys. And I think because had I just sort of on my motorbike firing up a hill, like, you know, I suppose the sort of the obvious question might be, well, what about guidebooks? Didn't you read anything that would perhaps tell you this? And there aren't many up-to-date guidebooks of Pakistan, which I think is it's an opportunity to feel like you're discovering something new and being adventurous. But I did read a few travelogues prior to that, and they were really informative. But of course, the one thing I didn't take out was that you have to be aware of the altitude at first. But there you go.
And you mentioned you chatted with some people as you were walking down the road or up the road. I can't remember which way. I'm assuming you don't speak a lot of Urdu, and so you were finding people who spoke English?
That's a really interesting question, because the northern areas are very poor. That said, in the Hunza area, there's a 98% literacy rate.
Uh-huh.
English isn't one of the main languages up there. In fact, there's 9 different languages. I'll come on to that a bit later. But there were so many tourists on the Babusa Pass and in the northern areas. But when I say tourists, they were tourists from southern Pakistan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so a lot of the, I suppose, middle class, more affluent people were coming up from Karachi, from Hyderabad, and Lahore, Islamabad, Rawalpindi, to visit the northern areas, because the northern areas is starting to become more accessible now because of the roads. There's a lot of publicity, people traveling up there. So there's a lot of Pakistani tourists there. They speak English. So southern Pakistan, it tends to be Urdu and English.
Uh-huh.
Northern Pakistan, depending on where you are, it could be one of 9 different languages, from Balti, Shinna. There's so many. These tended to be younger people, families. And the one thing is, they were really terribly proud here in Pakistan. And they were really happy to see someone who had come over and wanted to visit the country. It was really interesting, though. They sort of embraced phones really quite.
Sure.
Everywhere I went, I had people just say selfie. And I go, oh, yeah, okay, fine. You know, we have a selfie. And half the time, they didn't ask who I was. You're a foreigner. Like, great, let's have a selfie.
I've had that before, yeah. I always choose to believe that they're listeners of the show, but I don't think that's probably the case.
You should have a t-shirt with your with the podcast.
I'm probably wearing a Amateur Traveler t-shirt or a shirt or something while I'm on my travels. I wear almost nothing else. So.
Oh, that's great. That's a great idea. Well, I wonder, I mean, you know, they'll probably look at them in a few months' time and go, who is this guy? Delete them.
I've had people hand me their camera or indicate the camera, and I'm thinking, oh, they want me to take their picture, and because I was at a tourist spot, and then realize that, oh no, I want a picture with you. And it might be because I'm someplace where I'm particularly tall, at 6'3" tall, or blonde, or whatever, but or foreign, something different.
You're in someone else's country. They're really happy to see you. I'm really happy to be there.
Yeah.
That's great. I mean, I did say to one guy, I said, look, well, you could do with a picture, but as long as I don't end up on an advertising hoarding, the face of laxative or anything like that. And he assured me that wasn't going to happen. That's fine. You know, you say yes and you accept the consequences. So, and that happened throughout the entire time, apart from the Hindu Kush, which there were very few tourists, foreign or otherwise, in that area. But that was great. We, you know, after sort of chatting to the guys, we managed to get through. And we went through Chilas. And again, the other good thing about having a really good guide, like Sean said, he said to me, don't take any pictures in this valley. And it turned out it was a Sunni valley, quite fundamental. I don't mean that in a sort of, it's threatening in any way, but women don't come out. Uh-huh. They cover themselves. The men don't like to be photographed. The women certainly won't be photographed. So it was nice to have that warning, and you obviously have to respect that.
Sure.
We powered through Chilas, and we ended up in a town, rejoined the Karakoram Highway, and then went up to a town called Karimabad, which I really loved. I think it was the second night we spent up there. Now, high up, we're going towards the Chinese border. In fact, the road, this is the last major town before the Kunera Pass, which is the pass between China and Pakistan.
Uh-huh.
I believe it's the highest pass in the world, 4,700 meters, something like that. And everyone goes up there and has a selfie taken, apart from me, I have to say. But I really liked Karimabad. And when I got there, and I was fully rested from the journey over from the UK and had eaten well and had a walk around the town, I knew I was in the right place, because I got up at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning and stood out on the veranda that they had on the hotel and watched the sun come up. The sun caressed Rakaposhi Mountain, which is snow-covered, and the snow turned gold for a minute. And it was like almost a veil was dropping down the side of the mountains as the sun made its way down. The sounds at that time of morning, so you could hear about 2 kilometers away in the valley, there was the Hunza River charging down, and magpies, you know, flying around, coming to look for food, and the odd wagtail. And those sounds, first thing, sounds in the morning, you get. It was wonderful. People with the odd going out for a walk and the odd car just going. And there was a real kind of serenity about the whole place. I felt, yes, I'm here. This is it.
And the pictures I'm seeing is that this is a rather lush valley in a rather rugged landscape.
Absolutely. When we came down from Babusapar, they're very, very lush terraces. And then as you get rejoin the Karakoram Highway, it follows rivers and things, and it's quite steep. But wherever there is a patch of land where it levels off, then you get vegetation. And interestingly, as you get higher up as well, when you start to get off the Karakoram Highway into the villages, they have summer houses, summer fields. So
oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. They'll grow enough food for the winter and then come back down. You know, so they're always temporary. You'll see by the side of the road, as we were climbing down from Babusa Pass, there were beehives on the side of the road. They come up from Chilas, the farmers, and come up from Chilas. They tend to the fields, but they bring their bees with them. The spring flowers are there, and the bees make this wonderful honey. They sell it, and then they take the bees and off back down to Chilas for the winter. So any spare ground is really used for cultivation. I mean, it's very agrarian. There's no industry to speak of up this far.
And you mentioned Chilas. One question I had that you didn't mention is I see that there are some ancient Buddhist petroglyphs in the Chilas region.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get a chance to see those? Or
didn't see those because we were delayed getting over.
Got it. Okay.
But further up, between Gilgit and Karimabad, and towards a place called Pasu, there are four of those. I mean, they were quite remarkable, the stones. And I think I met another guide up there, and he took us there. And he was saying they were from about 5,000 to 1,000 BC.
Yeah,
and
that's what I was saying.
What they actually were was like a message board, like an ancient message board, like TripAdvisor, which is the way he described it, which I thought was wonderful because, you know, I got the picture immediately. He said, oh, yeah, you know, it's a message board. And there were many different languages there. So you could see Chinese, you could see slightly different script, it telling the travelers and the traders turn left at Karimabad and go over this pass, or and it was as simple as that. That was the sacred rock. Yeah, wonderful to see that. I mean, 5,000 BC, goodness me. You really get that sense of this well-trodden path there, you know, the Silk Roads and the traders. And so I didn't see them near Chilas, sadly, but I got to see them further up. And they are dotted all the way along the Karakoram Highway. It was a great experience.
So ancient signs that say eat at Joe's, basically, is what you're saying.
Yeah. That's it. Turn left at 20. You know, turn left in 20 minutes. Better for your camel. And also, I suppose, something where the nearest caravanserais were. And
sure, that would make sense.
We have our modern version, which we carry around on our phones, but really amazing. I really liked Karimabad. There's nothing much in the town.
An old fort, I understand.
Old fort. Well, there's Balti Fort and there's Atit. And this area, Gilgit, Baltistan, and particularly this is the Baltistan area, they called it Little Tibet because the countryside resembled Tibet. But also Alti Fort have Tibetan influences.
Okay.
So the Mir, the king of the area, the Hunza, built this with craftsmen who'd come down from Tibet, from the Tibetan plains through China. And as they were passing, of course, they traded not only goods, but also services and things like that. You'll see that a lot along the Karakoram. And there was a really old village, Ganesh, which again dated from, I think, about 180 BC. And there were some remarkable, really small, one-roomed mosques. I mean, just really small. And sort of three families, it was their legacy. They built these small mosques. And they were very, very simple rooms. But outside, there was this wonderful carving in this juniper wood. But the carvings had Hindu influences. So there was a swastika. There were Buddhist-like lotus flowers. And there was mihrabs as well. So the guide of this particular village was saying, well, it's because the craftsmen came down from China and up from India. And as they travel along the Silk Roads, and they got all these different influences, and they just made them into these mosques.
Huh.
But Balti Fort is really, it's worth a visit. I don't know if it's a myth or whether it's true, but as you come out of the Balti Fort, it's really, really high up. So it's quite high up on the top of the town, and you're probably 800, 900 meters above the Hunza River, and it's really quite steep. It drops off. And as you come out, there is this rock which stands by itself, which has a flat top, and it's about 4 foot from where you come into the fort. And apparently, to show that you're man enough to protect the Mir, of Hunza, you had to jump from the entrance to the rock and back. And those that failed, well, they failed. It was a one-time test. I looked down and was like, okay, well, fair enough. Luckily, they'd sort of fenced it off, so I wasn't in any way tempted to have a go. But the scale of the mountain and the valleys, it's really hard to describe, actually. I talked about the roads. I mean, the Karakoram Highway is paved for a lot of the way, but much of it is still under construction, and it's really dusty and rocky, and it's more of a boulder field, which people just have to drive across.
Well, and my impression is it's not like it's under construction and then they'll finish it and be done, but that it's going to need pretty constant attention because of the extremes of the weather and rock slides and all of that.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, because it is under construction. And then every year I went to a marvelous village called Tarashing, and every year the same people come and just make the road. This particular bit between Gilgit and Karimabad, it's paved in parts. But while I was in Karimabad, I shared a hotel with a cycle tour, like Tour de France type cycle tour. They had teams from Kenya. I think they had one from Iran, maybe. Certainly the Arab Emirates. And I shared my hotel with the Afghanistan cycle team, who one of them won. But I was trying to ask, well, the wheels, are they made of steel? I mean, how do you get through this? But I couldn't imagine these guys on these really thin road bikes traversing this road where I'd come up in a Jeep and was lucky to retain a mouthful of teeth on, because I'd been bounced around everywhere. I wondered if they actually ran with the bikes rather than cycled them, but they assured me they didn't. But that was great. So I really enjoyed Karimabad. And I went up a little bit further up towards Kunarab to Pasu, stayed there a night, and then decided to come back to Karimabad. On the way to Pasu, there is this bridge called the Husseini Bridge. It crosses the Hunza River, and I think it's about 300 meters long, this bridge. It's a footbridge only, and loads of tourists were there, but not many people on the bridge. You climb up and you wander down, and everyone's having a cup of tea and chatting. Met a really nice couple from Karachi there, and I said to him, oh, you know, you're going to go across the bridge. And he kind of looked at me and just sort of shook his head, no, it's not going to happen.
When you say it's a bridge, you're being rather charitable. I'm seeing videos of the world's most dangerous bridge. This is a hanging bridge with almost some supports in the base. It's not even like it's solid.
You got it.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
I tried taking pictures, but I decided, right, I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm going to go for it. And I think I sort of got a bit of a gung-ho attitude, because this young man from the village on the other side ran across.
Oh my God.
Just jogged across happily, you know, the rucksack on his back, some fresh vegetables and things on. See, he made that look really easy. This is going to be a breeze. Semi-macho idiot that I am, I decided to go across. When you look at it, you just think, oh, it's fine. You know, you start on, and the planks, which are probably about 6 inches wide, but they're about 2.5 feet apart, which is fine when you start off, because it's fine, because all you see is ground. But then suddenly you're 2 or 3 meters above this raging Hunza River, this gray river that is just surging down this valley, and it's boiling underneath you. And you think, okay, well, I'm going to hold on to this wire that they've strung across. You're holding onto the wire, and that's shaking, because someone else is at the other side. That's shaking as well. And so each step you make, you're thinking, okay, well, fine. Go on a little bit further. I'd probably got about 100 meters. How, I don't know. But of course, I forgot that if you've got 100 meters there, you've got to get 100 meters back. And I was sort of a third of the way through this bridge, and this bridge, the wind started to get up. So it was wobbling from side to side and up and down. And by now, two cable, which was about as high as my head, so you kind of felt safe, had now disappeared. And it's gone down to waist level. I think they call it disco leg. You know, your leg just shakes, doesn't stop shaking. But it took me about 20 minutes to edge my way back. It was both the bravest and the most stupid thing I did on the trip, I think.
And my understanding, there's the old bridge in tatters next to the new bridge.
That should have been a bit of a warning, shouldn't it? I should have looked and thought, okay, maybe not. The setting was magnificent. So you go across this bridge, and there's this path to a village which is hidden in the trees, these lush meadows. And in the background, you see what are known as the Pasu cones. These are these very spiky, sandstone-colored, you know, sort of a yellowy-colored mountains. Really beautiful setting. When I got back and I thanked the Lord and everyone else I knew, Sean looked at me, shook his head, you know, just to say, what on earth were you doing? And he took me, we were on our way to Pasu. He said, look, I know somewhere. We drove off up this, again, up this track, up a mountain, up over a ridge. And there was this oasis, this lovely lake, turquoise lake with fresh water. And I dipped my toes in that. And there was a small house beside it. And he knew the owner. I think it was, he had cousins and uncles everywhere, this guy. He called me and he said, oh, lunch is ready. And it was great. We sat by this wonderful lake, which you wouldn't know it was there. You wouldn't even know there was a track up, and had this wonderful curries and breads. And
well, and I'm looking at a picture of Batura Lake, which I wonder if it might be. It's at least one of these many turquoise-colored lakes in the region. You mentioned the river being gray. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of silt. There's a lot of ex-Himalayas being washed down the river.
You can tell where the river originates from by the color of it. So if it's gray, it's glacier, because it takes all the earth with it and all the rocks. And it's almost cement gray. It's a really deep, solid gray. Yeah, you're absolutely right. But there are some rivers that you can see which are pure spring water. And they're really nice. So you get sometimes snow melt or spring. And the interesting thing is some of these the tracks, and now I spent most of the time off the Karakoram Highway, I learned this, that if you go over, it's best to get through the rivers and the streams in the mornings, because in the afternoons, when the snow melt is in full spate, basically the rivers, and they're almost impassable. I mean, there's so many times when we actually had to jump out of the Jeep and help push some unfortunate man who had stuck his van or a Jeep or a truck, because there was so much water coming through and it became almost impassable. And that was in the afternoon. So invariably, you'd start early in the morning to try and get through these rivers.
You mentioned the highway again. And one of the things that I've seen pictures of, and I don't know if it's still the case, is these really colorful Pakistani trucks along the highway, almost like Filipino jeepney, many colors and such. That is still what you'd find on the Karakoram Highway?
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. I love them. And I was trying to hitch a ride on one. I said to Ashan, dump me here. I'm going to just see if I can hitch a ride. And he said, no, not on this road. When I think about it, he's probably right. But he said, oh, you know, you're interested in it. That's great. And so on the way back from Peshawar, he said, we're going to go to Rawalpindi. And he said, I'm going to take you to the train station because that's where the British army came and et cetera, et cetera. And he said, but I have a treat for you. So I said, yep, fine. And he took me to truck yard where they have the chassis of the truck, and then they make the entire truck in there. So various kind of various areas within that yard assemble this truck. And I saw how they were done. They welded onto the chassis, the boxes, they made that the hood like cap that you the color that the man who paints flowers on. So skilled and so wonderful. And a lot of the decorations are made with sticky tape. So different colors, sticky tapes. Yeah. So they'll cut them and then stick them on, but they do it so quickly and so wonderfully. So you get these bright yellows and reds and flashes of silver, and some of them have stories. So there was one truck there which had just been finished, and it had three MiG jets going up the side, which I didn't look terribly ethnic to me, but it was what the driver had ordered. And that again was a wonderful experience. So I spent almost an hour photographing and recording sounds and things and watching, marveling at each stage of this truck being built. But it's almost like fairground ride. When they start to hit these off the tarmac roads, the suspension seems to be quite soft. They wobble at alarming rates. So if you're behind one and you see it's almost, you're thinking, if that's going to go any further over to, you know, 30 degrees, it's going to end up down in that gorge. But they seem to right themselves. I heard a story, and I think it's probably true, but the drivers are so skilled. But to stay awake and alert, they smoke hash, marijuana. When I got to Rawalpindi, there was one driver who was taking a truck out and was going to deliver it to Karachi. And it was going to take him 3 days to drive it down there. And he showed me around. He showed me the air conditioning. The air conditioning was like a fan with a battery. He plugged this fan into a small car motorcycle battery. It started fine. He said, oh, yeah, air conditioning. I mean, yeah, great. And then he opened this box, and there was this quite a large quantity of marijuana. So I sort of figured that that was for personal use to get him through the desert down by Qatar and places. So it was so colorful. And all of them, and also the personal cars and Jeeps, have black cloth hanging down from mirrors and from bumpers and from various other places. And that's to ward off the evil eye, they say. Apparently it distracts the evil eye.
Okay.
It worked in our case, although I remember I was going down, I think, the Astor Valley, and I looked down this valley. I did see a couple of wrecks down there. So they are wonderful, those, and they carry so much. Really, really great. And it was marvelous that Sean took me to this place when he found out I was really interested in it. Again, another reason perhaps why you should get a guide and things rather than... I wouldn't have experienced that had I tried to do this myself. I could have gone to most of the places by myself, I imagine, because you can get Jeeps and things. But if you read some of the books I read, as adventurous as it is, it would take far too long, be uncomfortable and not flexible enough.
Well, and I'm seeing that if you're in Rawalpindi and you wanted to see the trucks, you want to go to Railway Workshop Road, which is where you'll find all the truck workshops. We need to move along here a little bit. What else do we want to talk about on the itinerary?
I better speed up because actually I'm still sort of only 4 days in. So from there, I went up to the Pasu Glacier. Again, a wonderful hike, about 4 hours up to the top of this glacier. Came back through Karimabad and then drove down the Karakoram Highway to Gilgit. Beyond Gilgit, we decided to go to a village called Tarashing. We had to go off the Karakoram Highway through a valley called Astor, the Astor Valley, which is incredibly steep. And again, they're starting to tarmac it and things, but quite incredible roads. And again, really, really steep sides of this valley. And you climb up and up and up and up. And eventually you get to this crossroad. And if you turn left, you go across the Desoi Plains. If you turn right, you come to this village of Tarashing, which, like I say, each year there's a landslide, and each year the same road crew come up and build the road. And we went over there, good work, which was great. And that was a lovely village. I stayed in there's only a couple of guest houses there, but it's the start of the climb for a mountain called Nanga Parbat, which is called the Killer Mountain. And it's one of the highest in the region, by 8,000 meters. Climbed over a glacier and went to these villages called Rupal, so lower and upper Rupal, and walked towards the base camp of Nanga Parbat. And that was a lovely village. It was nice to be there. But electricity went off at 10 o'clock, so I brought a torch with me when I was reading or writing my journal. And suddenly everything just went dark. And because, rather stupidly, I'd left my torch in my bag, it took me about 10 minutes to feel my way around and go to bed. But he said, oh, yeah, we just don't have electricity here. So the next night I was more prepared, so which was good. That walk to the base camp, which was about 6 hours, and the son of the guest house owner came with me. It showed actually the contrast between the various tribes and the various peoples in northern Pakistan. The language up there is called Shinas, which is the mountain language. But going through lower Rupal, I came out, shook my hand, we did selfies. The butcher was slaughtering a goat, and we chatted, and I took pictures. We walked on to Upper Rupal, and Upper Rupal is a temporary village, so it's a summer village. Really lush meadows leading up to the mountain, really wonderful. The people were really standoffish. I don't mean that in a bad way. You know, I'm a foreigner here, and quite right, this is their land, their things, and I would be slightly suspicious if someone I didn't know, especially a foreigner, came in. So I'm not criticizing in any way. It's really observing. And I found out later that that was a Sunni village, and the lower Rupal was a Shia village. It struck me that everywhere I went, you could almost tell that there was a difference between the sort of the sects. And in the Hunza region where I was, in Karimabad to Gilgit, there is Mali, which is a sect of Shia, and tend to be slightly more relaxed. And the further west I went over towards Chitral, Afghanistan, the more Sunni it became and slightly more formal. And you had to be careful. There were fewer women, virtually no women in some of the villages. And you drive through, and if they saw you coming, they would just run inside. Quite a contrast. So then from Tarshing, we went across the Desai Plains, which is a huge plain plateau. I think it's one of the highest plateaus in the world, if I'm not mistaken. And in spring, apparently, it's full of flowers. But when I went across, it was barren with rocks. But it was very beautiful in that barren way that boulder fields and things are. You know, there weren't many mountains because you were on top of this plain. It was about 8 hours bouncing up and down. There's no one road. Aim for something, and then if there's something in the way, you either turn round, go around it on the left or on the right. Eventually, you see something in the distance, and you head towards that. A time for reflection and holding on. There's loads of marmots everywhere and quite a few birds, but we ended up in Skardu, which is the gateway. It's the start, really, of the trails that go up to the big peaks like K2 and Mashaburn, places like that. Got to Skardu, and it was a Thursday night, and after sort of 8-9 hours on this jeep, dusty as hell, he said, "Do you want to go out to eat?" I said, "No, look, you know, a cup of tea and a little bit of food and a shower, that will sort me out." Went to bed, and then at 3 o'clock in the morning, I thought all hell had broken loose. At first, I thought it was an air raid siren, and it was just, you know how you're sort of in that half sleep, and you're not sure if you're dreaming it or it's reality. Well, this blaring noise, and eventually I came to, and I realized, because it was a Friday, it was the first prayers of Friday.
Oh, that early. Wow. 5:30 I would have expected, but wow.
3:20. And the other thing which sort of set me off was that the mosque and its speaker from the minaret was right by my room. So it was full blast. I got up, went and sat on the balcony, recorded it a bit. Well, I went on for about half an hour or so. But what was really nice, I do really like hearing the call to prayer.
You know you're somewhere else when you wake up at 5:30 in the morning, at least. I don't know about 3:30. I might have different thoughts.
You have to kind of wake up, and then you know you're somewhere else. But what was really nice was the echoes up and down the valley, and then more muezzin from various other mosques sort of joined in. So there's this cacophony and sort of reverb off the mountains. It was really, really nice. Unfortunately, I had to leave Skardu earlier than planned because originally I was going to go up this really famous road between Skardu and Gilgit, apparently one of the most dangerous roads in the world, which follows the Indus River. But true to form, there was a landslide and it was completely blocked. So we had to leave early, double back, go across the Desai Plains again. So more bumping up and down for 8-9 hours, and then drop down to the Karakorum and then Gilgit, you know, there, which, that's fine. That's what happens, and you accept it. There was a really nice hotel at the top of the Desai Plains, which sold boiled eggs and bread and tea, and it was and so I got to taste them twice. That was a good thing.
Well, and you mentioned the second highest plains in the world, I think, after the plateau of Tibet would be my guess. And you're talking about an average elevation of 4,100 meters or 13,000 feet, so quite high.
Very, very high. By this time, I was more used to the
the
altitude. But you feel like you're on top of the world. You almost feel like you're not actually traveling in the world. You're somewhere else. It's almost a, I wouldn't say lunar landscape, but certainly it felt like a very, very different place. Went to Gilgit. Gilgit's, for me, quite an interesting town because it was the frontier of British Empire in India, good or bad as that may be. But and I just went to see a couple of kind of British graves up there and found a photograph in an old book from about 1889. And I showed it to the guide and his son. He's from Gilgit. He said, "Oh, yeah, I know where this is." And so we went to find out where this picture was taken so I could get a look. It was this really, it was a government office, but it was really high security and everything. But true to form, he knew, or his wife knew someone there. And we got in, which was great, and had a look. And I just sort of held this photograph, this backdrop, and the commander there came and looked, and you know, all the things, and it was wonderful doing it. It's a very nice town, Gilgit. Big bazaar, a lot of people stop there to stock up if they're going to go mountaineering or trekking. So it was very, very, very good. We left there because we had a bit of a deadline because we had to get to the Shandor Pass. So now, basically, we're heading from Gilgit in the east across towards a city called Chitral, Afghanistan. So now we're heading east-west. So we drove along this, again, bumpy roads, all off to a small town called Gupis, which, again, very nice, high up. Not really much there. It was really the stopping out point. And then the next morning, got up and we came to the Shandor Pass, which for, I think, 50 weeks of the year is the pass. And there is a couple of temporary buildings there. Really beautiful between two sort of mountain ranges, a wonderful valley. Uh-huh. Really must be 2-3 kilometers wide, very lush, quite waterlogged with all the snow melts. But for this 1 week of the year, there's polo matches there.
I saw that.
It was incredible. Both Gilgut and Chitral, they compete. And Chitral always win. Three teams, A, B, and C. And Chitral always beat Gilgut. Except this year, Gilgut won the B team one. So that was great. There was a huge party up there. When I arrived, we arrived sort of slightly late, and it was dusk. And I said to Ashan, this looks like a refugee camp. You know, it really it had that kind of refugee camp vibe. There's tents everywhere, people ambling around, people playing football, all men, I have to say. There's a temporary bazaar, which you could go up. And it was really interesting. I had a walk around, but a lot of young people there, and they go and sing folk music and folk songs and dance. And it's just a really lovely atmosphere, almost like a festival. So I got invited into tents, and people were trying to make me dance, and I really don't dance, but you give it a go and then amble out of the way.
Well, and you say almost like a festival. This is the Shandor Polo Festival, so very like a festival.
It is the Shandor Polo Festival, but it's not just polo. Like I said, there's everything there, and a huge presence of police and army. And I never know about sort of Pakistan. You have to, obviously, quite law-abiding, and you hear stories, but I was walking around by the polo field and the bazaar, this temporary shopping area. There was the police compound and an army compound. And then there was this tent, which was a big, huge marquee, which was brightly lit. And I saw people going in and out. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. I'm just going to take a picture. And just as I put my camera up, a man came up to me and he went, no, don't take a picture, in a very nice way. And I said, oh, okay, is it army? Is it? He went, no. He said, that's the smoking tent. And I said, sorry, what's the smoking tent? And he said, that's the hash tent. That's where you go and smoke hashish. And also there's a barber in there. So I said, sorry, so hold on, this is right next door to the police compound and beside an army base. Sorry, that's a tent where people go to smoke. He says, yeah. He said, do you smoke hash? And I said, well, no, I don't. He said, oh, you can't really come in. I said, well, but you said he had a barber. Maybe I could get a shave. And he went, well, no. And I just suddenly thought that, there they are. There's all these young people, whoever, just going in, getting completely stoned and then having a haircut or a shave or something. So images of this barber who's off his head with hashish or something, trying to cut hair. So goodness knows what it would come out like. It just seemed incredibly liberal and complete incongruity with the police and the thing, and this big, huge hash tent, which was something out of the 60s that was, flashing light.
Well, and sometimes in that part of the world, and I don't know about this case, it's not so much liberal as cash is exchanged hands.
Yes, absolutely. The palms are oiled. I think they are. Yeah.
Not to find that there is gambling in the... No, so...
Also, obviously you can't get alcohol until I got to the Shandor Pass, and these young guys from Gilgut who were smoking and everything. And I sat down and chatted to them, and they played me a song, and they said, we're going to sing you a song. And the guy said, we probably need to talk to you now before we get too wasted. He said, here, do you want a drink? So I sniffed this thing, and he said, oh, yeah, that's Hunza water. And I was like, okay, Hunza water, right. So it was the alcohol. I took a sip, but goodness. Almost felt the enamel coming away from my teeth. It was really rough. But it was great fun. I mean, it was really great fun. And the polo, I don't really understand the game of polo, but it was really good to watch. The crowd getting into it. I had to sit in the VIP section, which was great. So I had people explaining everything to me. Look, an excuse for men to hit each other with hammers, whilst riding a horse, but it seemed incredibly violent. It was marvelous. It was just a wonderful experience, which I perhaps wouldn't have had otherwise. Really chuffed to have had that. Apparently, within 2 days of the festival finishing, it's clear there's no rubbish, there's no tents, there's these temporary buildings, and there's polo ground. You know, it's back to normal, and it's then one of the routes across from Gilgit to Chitral. So I ended up in Chitral, and by this time, that sort of time was running out a little bit, really. Okay, I got to Chitral, and Chitral, like I say, it has a real frontier flavor about it. And to give you an example, I was walking around in the bazaar, and you could buy Chinese dumplings and dim sum there, and there were quite a few Afghans and stuff. So cut a long story short, I left there and went up to what, for me, I think was the highlight of the trip, and that was to visit the Kalasha people. The Kalasha, there's 4,000 of them left, and they live in three hidden valleys up towards Afghanistan. I only spent 3 days there, and I could have spent 2 weeks, 3 weeks there, just in that one valley. So I was completely entranced by the whole place. The people, I mean, they're not Muslim. It was originally called Kafiristan, Kafir being, well, people say infidel, but I think it's more non-believer.
Uh-huh.
That area was called Kafiristan. It's now called Nuristan. And that stretches from Chitral across into Afghanistan, that whole area. And that's the place of light, I think that translates as. But the Kalasha people, they're under a bit of pressure from the local Muslims to try and convert. They believe in spirits, and they worship nature and trees, and everything has a spirit, and they worship it. And I was very lucky because Ashan knew one of the valleys is very commercial, but he knew a hidden valley called the Romba Valley. It's no longer hidden now, of course, but they're called the Romba Valley, and he knew the chief there who had a guest house. So we went up there, very, very narrow-sided. It's only about an hour or so out of Chitral, 2 hours maybe out of Chitral. And as soon as you get there, you cross a bridge and you enter a completely different world. It isn't Pakistan. It's somewhere else. So the men are dressed in shalwar kameez like everywhere else in Pakistan, but the women are in black robes and they're embroidered in beads and wools, mainly greens and oranges, bright blues. They wear cowrie, these shells that they sew onto headdresses. And yeah, they come out and they greet you. Women just were interested in me, and they chatted to me without men there. They were not equal, but the women were slightly more open and approachable and not afraid to come in. They weren't inhibited by the religion. I was lucky enough, and I still in contact with chief's son. The chief said, oh, here's my son, he'll guide you around the village. So I had this guide, and we went in and out of people's houses. They were making costumes for the dancing ceremony, which was going to happen in about a week or so before then. He took me to their ancient temples, which the temple makes it sound grand, but you'd walk along a river over a juniper bridge, up a valley, past these, into the summer areas. And then he said, no women are allowed past here. And so, fine. So we'd walk through, and there was this courtyard, 30 meters square, and it was some very simple carvings and a plinth, almost like an altar, but with trees over the branches. And there was some blood from a recent ceremony that had happened there. But no women are allowed in there. So women aren't entirely equal, but it was very, very simple. But that's where they go to worship and things. So I was really privileged and lucky to have seen that. And then I spent time with them. And like I say, walking in other people's houses, and I walked around and was invited by one woman to have a cup of tea and watch her sew some wool onto a that she was making for her daughter. It was really nice. I can't describe how at home I felt there, how sort of peaceful and how welcome. And that was really nice. But in contrast, from there, I decided to, with Shakil, the son of the chief, to walk up to a village, which was actually turned out to be on the border of Afghanistan. I didn't realize. He said this is on the near the border of Afghanistan. And when you say near the border, you think, oh, it's a mile or so away. It was the actual border. This village was on the border. So we climbed up there, which was great, and complete contrast. They were Nuristani Afghanistans. Like I say, the children, the women all ran away, and the men followed me everywhere. So it was, okay, I'm here. I didn't particularly want to go into Afghanistan. I'm not one of those sort of tourists that tick things off. It was very interesting, the contrast. And then we walked down when they were logging juniper high up, and that the wonderful citrus smell of freshly sawn juniper logs. The calash, it was a really wonderful experience. And like I say, there are issues for them, but I hope that they survive. I'm sure they will. Like I say, there's 4,000 left. I could stay there for a week. In fact, for perhaps some of your more adventurous listeners, you can probably get there and spend time just there by, you can either drive, there's a kind of new tarmac road up to a pass called the Lowry Pass. After that, it becomes a boulder field, but it's about 8-9 hours from Islamabad.
Oh, that close. Wow.
I'm in the UK, so 8 or 9 hours, and I'm south of France. <You know. laughs> There are flights every day from Islamabad up to Chitral, but I say every day, they don't go every day. It depends, because they have to fly through the mountains. So they have to, you know, the weather is weather dependent. But I think I saw a ticket for $63. Great value. It's an hour and a half to Chitral, and then you're another couple of hours up there. So it's doable just to do that.
Well, I do want to start to wind this down. Anything else we should cover, though, on your itinerary before we get to some of our wrap-up questions?
No.
It's a fascinating episode. And they were not on my radar at all, the Kalash people. So interesting to hear about. We're going to do some wrap-up questions. You're standing in the prettiest spot in northern Pakistan. You've described so many. If I had made you pick one, where are you going to pick?
Out of so many, it would have to be Karimabad. Okay. On the second, third night of my stay, that I was at the place called the Eagle's Nest, looking down there. And as I told you, the Huns are rushing down, this surge of water and the sun on Rakaposhi Mountain. That's a really difficult question, Chris, because every morning was another one.
There was some stunning pictures that I've been looking at here as I've been talking to you. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Pakistan.
I think it was probably the marijuana tent, yeah. the shish tent on the Shandor bus.
I don't know if that was worse than the drivers getting stoned on their drive across this mountain highway. That does not seem like a good combination to me. But
no, it doesn't at all. The food is good. I mean, food is worth mentioning. There's so much. I mean, there's so many standout moments. I went with some expectations, but to be honest, they were all completely blown out of the water.
Well, you say the food, but we haven't talked about food. What kind of food would you recommend us to try while we're there?
The homemade breads, the goat curries.
I was going to guess goat, okay.
Yeah, goat curries, definitely. The tea, have the breakfast. In the winter, they have a breakfast, which is black tea boiled with milk. You put salt in, and then rancid butter, and then bread. No, I just didn't go that far.
You lost me at the rancid butter, actually, but...
Absolutely. Not going down there at all. But black tea with milk and salt actually is surprisingly nice. So dipped with a chapati dipped in it. It sets you up for the day.
Well, and our last question, if you had to summarize northern Pakistan in three words, what three words would you choose?
Magnificent, wonderful, unexpected.
Okay, excellent. Our guest again has been David Hardeen from the travelwarnsatchel.com. David, thank you so much for coming on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your love for Pakistan.
Thank you so much. I've relived it again with you, Chris. Happy about that. Thank you ever so much.
This has been a long show, but I did want to officially announce the opening of the Amateur Traveler Patreon. And Patreon, for those of you who are not familiar, is a method that you can support with regular monthly payments creative projects like podcasts, either this one or some podcast you like better. But Amateur Traveler now has a way that listeners can help support the show. It helps pay for the editing and some of the other costs of the show. I wasn't anticipating that it would be as helpful as it has turned out to be since I'm working for a startup right now that missed a round of funding, so I'm kind of on a 75% pay cut. But my thanks go out to those people who signed up even before this announcement. So the first five patrons being Tom Shaner, Savio Wong, Nathan Yang, Jeff Ulfs, and Colin McFadden. And you may recognize a couple of those names. Jeff has been on the show twice as a guest, and Savio has been on the show once as a guest. And thanks so much for supporting Amateur Traveler. For those of you who are not interested or not able at this time to be a patron, that's not a problem. I'm still planning on doing free versions of this show, but doing some special episodes for the patrons of the show. And then also, we just launched an Amateur Traveler store on Etsy. And so if you go to the amateurtraveler.com website, you'll see links now to the Amateur Traveler store. And we've already sold the first couple Amateur Traveler branded mugs, and that doesn't count the one that I'm now drinking my morning tea of. So a couple changes in the show, and I thank all of you who have supported it over the years with comments and reviews and all sorts of things, and those of you who talked me into doing a Patreon program. With that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe. I know that I should be